get the meeting started. I know we don't have a quorum yet, but hopefully we can get things started. That's what we need.
I see they've got a little back chair.
So I think this morning we're going to start with the Council on Minnesota Indian Affairs. So I think we have, is it the Executive Director?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. If you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Well, good morning, Representative Howell. My name is Anna Marie Hill, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. And thank you for having me here to testify this morning.
Thank you.
Yes. Now, in front of you, I do have a few things for you to look at. First of all, I'll be following a brief PowerPoint, so you can, and I'll try to be brief and as quick as possible. And also, I've put in, you have in your packet of information for Indian Affairs Council, you have our 2015 legislative agenda, and you also have our report to the governor. Our annual report to the governor that we have to do every single year. In addition, I believe that in your packets you also have our agency profile and our budget that we had to prepare this year, and including in that is the budget. So I'll go briefly through the spending budget and talk about the details of that and our legislative ask after that. So are there any questions before I start?
No, I think you can just begin.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I'll be, yes.
Excuse me. Yeah. I guess we have enough folks here, so I'll call the meeting to order. And Representative
motion,
Nash.
Motion to adopt.
Thank you. So we're going to, Representative Nash moves the minutes of February 17, 2015. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion passes.
Okay.
Please continue.
Thank you, Representative Powell. So I'll be starting with this, the PowerPoint that I have that's copied for you so you can follow along and feel free to ask questions at any time. So Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, our statute is 3.922. All the duties of the statute and what we do are highlighted there. Our first slide, I have Native Nations in Minnesota. One of the most frequent questions for anybody, whether you're members or whether you're members of the public, in the public education system in the state of Minnesota is where are tribal nations? We've detailed those on the map. There are 11 different sovereign nations in Minnesota. We do refer to them as Native Nations. There are 7 Ojibwe nations, which are found basically in the top half of the state, and there are 4 Dakota communities in the bottom. Indian Affairs Council represents all of those 11 Native Nations in Minnesota. Briefly, Minnesota American Indian population. We are approximately 1 to 2% of the population. 22% of the American Indian population live on Indian reservations. 20% are in adjacent counties. 32% of the overall population lives in Hennepin County and Ramsey County alone. 24% live elsewhere in the state. We're all over the state. Indian Affairs Council represents the tribal nations, but also represents the American Indian people of Minnesota. So, next slide, next page. We were established almost 52 years ago in 1963, and we are primarily a liaison between the state of Minnesota and the 11 tribal nations within the state who represent the tribal people of Minnesota. I need to add, though, that there are many tribal people in Minnesota, not just members from the 11 nations, but we also represent the wide variety of individuals that we have coming from all over the United States, and we have from Canada. My legislative legislative director who's in the room right over there, Melanie Franks. She comes from Canada. So we represent Indian people throughout the country and beyond. Minnesota was the second to create such a department, but we are a unique department in the United States. There are several Indian Affairs Councils or commissions. This Indian Affairs Council is unique in that the 11 tribal nations are the governing board, and I am not appointed by the governor, which is also a unique situation in the United States. Our council history dates back as early as 1924. 1924 is significant because that was the Indian citizen, when American Indian people, although we were first people of the nation, we were the first people, we became citizens of the United States in 1924. And at that time, the state of Minnesota developed an Indian Affairs Commission to deal with certain things and issues between the federal government and the tribal people of Minnesota. The council provides, what we provide is a forum for, and we advise state government on issues of concern to American Indian and American Indian people and communities of Minnesota. That is very, very important. The important is that we provide this forum for for sovereign entities to come together and have discussions, which are often not happening in our everyday world between people. And it's also very important that I stress that we are a liaison office between the two governments. The vision and the mission have been around much longer than I've been around. We strive for social, economic, and political justice for all American Indian people living in Minnesota. And we also embrace our traditional cultural and spiritual values. Very important vision. The mission of the Indian Affairs Council is to protect the sovereignty of the 11 Minnesota tribes and ensure the well-being of American Indian citizens throughout the state. And I must add, the mission and the vision remain today. There's very important work that we need to do today to achieve the goals that we've stated. Membership. The membership is, we have the, I would say we have one of the largest boards that state government has. We have 28 member board. I've detailed here, we have one member designated from tribal presidents of the following 11 nations: Fond du Lac, Grand Portage, Mille Lacs Band, White Earth Band, Boisfort or Net Lake, Leech Lake, Red Lake. Those are the Ojibwe nations. The seven that I stated were in the upper half of Minnesota. And the Upper Sioux community, Lower Sioux community, Shakopee, and Prairie Island. Those are every tribal nation has an available seat on the board. There is not a mandate for tribal nations to sit on the board, and they can opt out. They do not. That's not a mandate that they are mandated to a state board. Membership continued. Governor's office, official staff of the governor, is on our board, and the commissioners of education. So we have a very large board. Education, human services, natural resources, human rights, employment and economic development, corrections, Minnesota housing, finance, Iron Range resources, health, transportation, veterans affairs, administration, and we have two members from the House and two members from the Senate.
Director,
yes.
Hill,
mm-hmm.
is there any tribal nations that opt out?
Yes. Representative Howe, there are. We have one tribal nation, Upper Sioux, that does opt out right now and chooses to not be a member of our state of the board. So, and that in throughout the history, there's been several members and tribal leaders that have opted out. My very own, I'm a member of Red Lake Nation. Years ago, Roger Jourdain did not sit on the Indian Affairs Council, and there's a variety of reasons for this, and we certainly respect their right to do so. Duties of the council. These are detailed in Minnesota Statutes 3.922. I did write some of these duties down. I'll go through those very, very quickly. We analyze and make recommendations to tribal elected leaders and members of the legislature. So we're continually doing the work of analyzing legislation, analyzing the work that's done. We also make recommendations. We bring the recommendations of tribal leaders. We have to know a lot of things about a lot of different areas, about the areas that the seated board members. So we have to have a wide breadth of knowledge of education, DNR. Also, it's very, I say I'm a little bit of an expert in many things and not a whole lot in one particular area, but it certainly is a full way of existing. We assist in establishing Indian advisory councils with state agencies. So we give consultation. I give consultation to state agencies on establishing what is the best way to work with American Indian people and how can we establish these advisory councils. And how can we maintain the advisory councils? Indian Affairs most often supports that the work of the advisory councils that are out in the Department of Human Services or in the Department of Health or in the Department of Education remain intact. And we wouldn't, state government is always looking to achieve an end goal with these advisory councils, which is to solve a problem. And when the problem's solved, then I suppose we can dissolve the advisory councils. But as many of you are aware, we have many things, achievement gaps, we have disparities, just enormous disparities in the state of Minnesota that are unfortunately some of the worst, if not the worst in the nation. And we need to come together as entities with state government and the legislature to definitely work together and solve these problems. We assist state agencies in defining these groups, committees, councils. Number four, we assist in ensuring the provision of resources and delivery of services. We're often called on to do that duty as well. Number five, we recommend to tribal governments and the state government the means to enhance those delivery of services. So we are talking to folks all the time about enhancing the delivery of services. And number six, we assist state agencies in implementing and updating studies of services delivered to the federally recognized tribes. So we have to be involved in, we are involved in, in every single one of these duties we are involved with on any given day. Number seven, we provide for the benefit of all levels of state government a continuing liaison. That to me is one of the most important things, and that is one of the hardest things to define. A liaison is an individual that is like or an entity in between two entities that we can provide the service, we can give you good consultation and guidance on what is the best way to work on issues of importance or critical issues with American Indian people. And basically what we have to do is put the entities together, establish a means of communication between sovereign entities, and then also we have to, that's pretty much what we do. We often don't track that work, we don't track the results, but we continue to remain hopeful that the most meaningful, or the individuals who are able and capable of changing laws and doing things that will benefit the people, will come together and do the right things on behalf of the people that we're working with and on behalf of your constituents. So we interact with private organizations involved with Indian people, so we're involved in the private sector. We're involved in economic development. Yes, you have a question?
Yes, we have a question from Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you could clarify back on three slides ago on the where you said assist in ensuring provisions of resources. What does that mean?
Well, that is just, we assist everybody in how, if somebody is asking, how can I provide a resource to a tribal nation? Oftentimes there's a barrier of communications between individuals such as yourself and between the tribal nations. And how can we provide those resources to this individual? If we can't even perhaps find somebody that we can do this work with. So you have another question? So, and we insist in providing consultation on a wide variety of issues that come forward. So, and technically, probably, if, you know, so did you have a further question,
Representative Luna?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, pretty much most of your slides say that just different ways.
Sure.
My question is, how do you measure whether you are making things better or not? Basically, my translation of most of these slides is that we facilitate individuals getting towards government resources. That you're just a conduit. Would that be a fair assessment?
Director.
Representative Howe, Representative Lunan. I guess if you term liaison as a conduit, then that would be a representation or an interpretation that you would have. How do we ensure that the individuals are having a better way of life, per se, or that lives are getting better for individuals? It's by working with two entities. And can I measure at the end of the day exactly if I'm having an effect to make somebody's life better, perhaps as a public servant or as an individual or an entity that does the jobs that we do, perhaps we can't see that end result every single day. But we certainly have to keep working with individuals such as yourself on committees and such as the individuals on the board members who have the authority to make changes, pass laws, do things that are for the benefit of the people, and to ensure that the voices are still heard or the most important needs still come forward. It amazes me every single day how little information that we have about the needs of the people that need, that are most in need of our public services. Those are the individuals that we don't see. Those are the individuals that don't even have the luxury to know who I am and who you are and what we're doing. And so the measurement, a conduit, are we a conduit? Are we a liaison office between two entities? Yes, we are. And very concretely, those entities still do not oftentimes know how to work together, largely due to the fact that Minnesota does not have a system that educates to the first people and the history of the state and of the indigenous people here, which we are also working to change. Does this help? We can have further conversations pertaining to this.
Let's.
And very rich conversations. So,
thank you. Representative Luna, one follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my point is that I'm familiar with, you know, some of the First Nation groups.
Sure.
And I know that they have functions within their entities that are doing this very same thing, and it seems like a 100% replication or duplication of effort. I guess I would be curious that if this went away, if anything would change at all. That's just a comment.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Lane has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these the duties that you have listed here in statute?
Yes, they
are. So in other words, the legislature listed these duties for you when this council was created.
Representative, throughout the years since the council has been created, there have been different duties that have been added to the statute. The most previous duty, and I won't run through all of these for you, but the most previous duty has came about in 2007 after I started as executive director, and there was a gap between consultation between the governor and consultation that had to occur. We do not talk to each other. The very real fact is that we still do not talk to each other as tribal people and as state government, as nation to nation. We still don't in the state of Minnesota. So with the most previous duty that came about in about 2007 and 2008 was a summit between the governor and the tribal leaders, because there was this gap in communication, and a mandated summit on a yearly basis, which we're preparing for now. So the governor does know and has an awareness about the single most important issues right now in the tribal nations. One of the most common things, I've been doing this work for a long time, and I my previous work 20 years ago or so was as a government relations specialist or a person that worked for my tribe, which was Red Lake Nation. And at that time, the issues that we still talk about today are the issues that were pressing at that time. And there was often, and what I've heard for years and years and years is, how come I didn't know about this issue of importance, be it the DNR, be it the wolf hunt, be it education, the disparity, and so on? They're not known. So the entity of Indian Affairs Council is an entity that, although very, very small, we still are a voice for the people in state government. Absent that, it would be it would be unrepresented. So,
Representative Blaine.
Yes, I just want to comment that these are statutory obligations of your council, and I'll just say to the committee that the bill that I'm putting forth will have the other three councils, not this one, because this one has some nation-to-nation work that I'm not prepared at this time to deal with. So the bill I will bring forth will be for the other three councils.
Thank you. Director Hill, continue.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for those questions. They're very thoughtful. We can engage much in the future about them. So on to Item 9, develop educational programs. We do help develop educational programs, community organization problems, programs. I work with community organizations, educational system, leadership development programs, motivational programs. I speak all of the time for public school systems throughout the state. I speak for colleges all over the state of Minnesota. I provide individuals a lot of support in understanding Tribal Nations of Minnesota, because keep in mind this one thing: our educational system does not represent the area at all, if very, very little. I am a person who is a liaison for teachers. I am often a first call for teachers to find curriculum, first call for teachers to find American Indian people to speak out there. Now, we have the worst disparity in education in the nation. So we're obviously missing something. And so I'm quite often that person that goes out there and helps people understand something about the tribal nations and the tribal people, such as myself, in Minnesota. So I'll continue. Number 10, we work with the Commissioner of Human Services. They provide us data, concrete data. They provide us their agendas. They provide us the work of the Tribal State Agreement work. We're very closely involved with the Department of Human Services. There are very complex areas in the Department of Human Services that we work with and connect very well. We have a liaison in that department that works very closely with Indian Affairs Council and the leaders. We prepare, and this is the final one that came about after I came, and that's number 11, is we work yearly. We prepare, Indian Affairs Council prepares the agenda on behalf of the tribal leaders for the Governor's Tribal Leader Summit that occurs yearly. Yes?
Representative Rumbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ma'am, when you said education.
Yes.
Don't know much about it, but my school district does have an Indian education program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's across all school districts, if it's a mandate, or if that was something my district decided to
sure.
do. Do you know much about it?
Sure. Representative, what is your district?
Centennial.
Centennial mm-hmm. district. So you're up.
It's a suburb, you know.
Suburb north of here,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm,
by Forest Lake.
Right.
Yeah, where I live. So, not all schools have an Indian education system. The school that I grew up in, Aiken, Minnesota, there's a complete absence. There are mandates in the Department of Education law that state if you have a certain amount of students, and I believe it is maybe even as low as 11 students, that you have to provide a parent education group. In that, and that you can have an Indian education system, but there are not mandates, and also how they teach out to the Indian education and do the work and hire the teachers and so on and so forth. We work constantly to help provide relevant guidance, consultation. I haven't worked particular with Centennial School District, but I work with many different school districts, Anoka, Hennepin, St. Paul, West St. Paul, certain ones, but not all of them do in the state of Minnesota. Some places that you travel to in the state are largely absent of any contributions of our history, and that is to all our detriment. So,
Chair,
yes,
and Ms. Hill, perhaps it has to do just with enrollment, size of enrollments. You know, the larger suburban districts then probably do have a component of Indian education, if you're saying it's based on the number of students. So.
Well, the parent advisory representative, chairman, there's a mandate stating that you have to have a parent advisory committee for a certain amount of students within there. But enrollment is a factor. But there's a history in the state of Minnesota that eliminates the voices of our first people. So, and that history we're still fighting really hard to catch up with, so that we can have our history books represent the true history of Minnesota. So,
Director Hill, I'm going to have to ask you to
absolutely,
because we got a lot to work on. Can you kind of summarize
yes.
this and then get to the budget request?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, we can go safely over to that. You know, if we flip the page right here and we take a look at a couple of programs that
I have one question from Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, my question is, I represent a suburban district, a relatively large one, and a few years ago I received a call from representatives of the Native American community parents in the Robbinsdale schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the gist of the meeting was that they're often overlooked simply because of the statistics that are used.
Mm-hmm.
Large school district, a significant number of Native American students, but yet often not meeting the threshold as a percentage of students, and therefore not as engaged as they might be if that same number of students was in a smaller school district. And I'm curious how you reach out to those communities. And then also I noticed on several slides there's reference to federally recognized tribes.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
You talked about the tribes in Minnesota initially, but do we have significant numbers of Native Americans who are part of tribes that are not recognized by the federal government?
Chairman, Representative, those are several good questions. First of all, I'll kind of start at the back. We do have members that, we have a lot of individuals that are non-members or considered non-members. The acknowledgement of them is that they are American Indian, if that is their identification. We also have, I do not know the numbers of individuals who are considered non-members of, members of non-federally recognized tribes. And a couple would come to mind that are individuals that are working on their federal recognition. I don't know those concrete numbers. I do know that in the demographics that we deal with, so if I'm talking about 1 to 2% of the population, those are the individuals that report American Indian to a certain amount. And those individuals would not identify, I don't recall the identifiers in the census, whether or not they identify as from a tribe or not from a tribe. But the work that we do for American Indian folks, it's, to me as an individual, and this is just my value system, it is irrelevant whether or not you're from a tribe or not. I happen to be from a tribe, but we represent American Indian people. Many of our children, because of our history and our enrollment, many of our children, our grandchildren, my grandchildren, are unable to be recognized members of my own tribe. Which means, and we're working very hard to make some contributions and changes that will actually keep this going. However, we are the only individuals in the entire, world that carry a card that identify who we are. Our history is very rich. I would love to help individuals understand those reasons for looking at us as individuals with a certain blood quantum. Those are excellent questions. Robbinsdale has just always been a leader. When it comes to American Indian education, I'm a leader of the Voices for the People. You've had some phenomenal people in the Robbinsdale School District and that have contributed on our studies and that have worked very, very hard to do changes and reform. Department of Education is a very thriving place, has been historically, and one of the first in Minnesota, first in the nation, to have a Department of Indian Education. And that was eliminated several years ago. It just kind of dwindled away. But the fact of the matter remains, and we're trying to build that up. So they bring individuals from school districts forward to work on various studies, to work on research reports and those contributions, and Rosedale is one of the leading. And I do know that their frustration is because they are not the size of Anoka-Hennepin. They're not the size of, St. Paul. So they deal with certain issues such as funding and obtaining enough resources, and they're just a district that wants to do more. Mm-hmm. I wish every district wanted to do more regardless of number or not. Because I'm a believer in the history. So, yes.
I've got another question from Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's fine. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
And Ms. Hill, if you could just, in a brief statement, what would be your biggest challenge you have working, with the council and also the 11 tribes? What's your biggest challenge?
Representative Detmore, it's really hard to summarize. My biggest challenge is to help people understand that the contributions of the American Indian people are the history of Minnesota, I do believe. In the leading challenge of the duties that are assigned, I believe that if after all of the years of doing this work, that education rises to the top. I really do believe if we have the worst disparity in the nation, in the state of Minnesota, something's going wrong in how we're teaching out. We can blame the kids all we want. You know, we can blame the parents all we want. But basically, we have individuals like myself who are being told, well, you're the first people, you're the original people of the land, you're the culture, the history, and then you walk into the school or you walk into an entity and you're not represented. Well, a child that's not represented definitely has lacks an identity in that school. And because of our history, because of what we've been through, many things that we haven't done ourselves, you know, because we're all relatively young, I'd like to say that. So it's a history that precedes us. Education, if we were to have an educational system that thrived on teaching to children as children and not as numbers and standards and constructs and tests and so on, I'm very passionate about that, then we would, I will get to my point very quickly, but then we would be able to create true reform and changes. Health would change, opportunities would change, economic development would change, opportunities in the school and the education. And my biggest desire is to help others, individuals like yourselves, to change for them because they can't do it
to the budget
themselves.
Request.
Yes.
Thank you. Director Hill, if we could move
yes.
to the budget request.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're buttoned up against it.
And part of the budget on the slides is we do run certain programs within this, and this is part of the legacy money that we receive into Indian Affairs Council. Financial report. You do have the agency profile, I believe, in front of you. If not, we have detailed some of those details in the annual report for you. So our budget is, and I'm not looking at the exact, because I don't have the annual report in front of me. I forgot to bring that. I apologize. But it's approximately $550,000, I'm going to say approximate, a couple thousand left that we currently have in our general fund budget. We did put in a request forward to the governor this year. We asked for an additional $100,000 to help us with some of these programs that we are actually doing to increase our staff, to work harder on the pressing issues that are coming forward with other programs, education being a leading one. But currently, we our service area, as I've said, is the entire state of Minnesota, and our board is very large. We also have the employees that we staff currently. I'm the executive director. I have a cultural resources director. I have a legislative assistant, an executive assistant, and a cultural resources specialist that are all funded under our general fund. And the operational budget in and of itself, if you would like to see the detailed operational budget, we work with the Department of Administration, Smart Services, who do all of our finances, help us work in putting together the operational budget each year, follow all of the laws and guidelines pertaining to that. We did also, the governor made a recommendation to, and then another part of what you see here, though, perhaps the larger part of the pie that you're looking at, with regards to the funding, we do receive approximately about close to $2 million in legacy funds, and that's to run different programs, the Dakota Ojibwe Language Revitalization Program. That's separate from the general fund and what you're concerned with today. We also have a federal fund that comes in yearly. It's been coming in since the early 80s, and that is to hire an individual as an Office of Economic Opportunity Specialist, a specific liaison with DHS. Yes.
Thank you, yep. Director Hill. Exactly mm-hmm. what is the change request?
The change item. The change item request, the governor recommended that we have a 1.8% increase, and that is largely to cover the costs of increasing the increasing salaries, the increasing costs of insurance, the costs that due every single year you have to factor in a certain percentage for in anticipation of the cost. And as you do that, the operations you have to remove from the other. We've remained fairly steady in what our budget is since I've been here, and I'm going on 10 years here. So we have not received a substantial increase. We did receive a $100,000 increase, but that was in lieu of, or a thought with the legislature at the time, was that it would be in lieu of the legacy money, but you cannot substitute legacy money for general fund money. So that recommendation of the governor was just to cover the basic increases of the cost. So I firmly don't believe that anybody should be unemployed. That's been my ultimate goal in since I've been here as the executive director, I'm not going to put anybody on the unemployment rolls. So, but as you work on the budget year after year and you factor in 2.6% for salary increases, this costs more, this costs more, you have to take a look at the individuals and whether or not you can cover their living expenses. So that's what that governor's recommendation is for.
So, Director Hill, as the Chair Anderson always asks, she's requesting the commissioners and the directors to provide us a breakdown of specifically where that 1.8% is going to go and how you plan to put that forth in your budget. So,
yes.
if you can provide that to the committee at a future time, that would be great.
Sure, I absolutely will. Absolutely.
Any other questions from the committee? Otherwise, we appreciate your presentation and your committee report. And I think Representative Kahn.
Yes. Sorry to have been late, but one of the things that has been, and so this was discussed, just shut me up, but the problem of the schools, of the Indian schools on the reservations and the federal responsibility for these and how badly that's been handled. Is the council getting involved in that at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, we hear about the issues. We do not work specifically on federal issues. We address issues if resolutions come forward to support certain schools, certain changes, certain reform that are passed on to the legislature, to the governor's office, and to the fed and to the federal level. We will connect as a liaison between federal entities too. We will have individuals from the Department of Education in the federal area speak to us, consult with us. We're very, very aware. Do we work on it directly? We mainly work on the issues of state government. So, excellent question.
I guess I know the schools are federally funded, but I think the education of all the children of the state is a very important state issue.
Absolutely.
And I really think, we just...
Absolutely.
Yeah. All I know about this is, of course, what I've read in the newspapers, but it certainly looks pretty awful, and it certainly
yes.
looks as if it's something that, we should all be taking taking an active stance in, and I think your council Absolutely. Ought to also. I don't think you're restricted to state issues mm-hmm. by any means. And I'm also interested in the language problem, in the language issue. I guess I went to a rally or a meeting on the banks of the Mississippi at some point this summer, and the publications on language came from mm-hmm. I think was yeah. it didn't come from your account from Minnesota. I thought they came from somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered if there's been any results from that. If there anything that we can look at from that
absolutely
give way language
absolutely
is there
absolutely.
A dictionary or some children's is there anything that
oh
we've seen on that
yeah Mr. Chair, I realize there's Representative Kahn. There is just an enormous amount of research that Indian Affairs Council has contributed in. We have a feasibility study at the Legislative Law Library that we published in 2012 as a result of our working group that came together. We've studied languages all over. We rely on linguists, people, and experts in language and consultation. And yesterday, I was just working with somebody who's working on revitalizing the language in Canada and who is an integration of this language. We are revitalizing a world language. We are revitalizing world languages in Minnesota, and Minnesota is contributing to that revitalization through legacy funding. Representative Kahn and I have to thank you for the leadership that you put forward in securing this. If we restore the language, we restore the cultural and we restore, and we can do many, many things if we can restore languages that have been lost.
Well,
Mr.
Chairman. Well, what I was impressed was by the existence of things that seem very useful to the people who haven't had exposure to the language. Like, sorry, this chair is really in the way, but children's books and dictionaries and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yes, yes.
That was just a product. When I looked at it, I assumed that it had come from the Minnesota project, but it hadn't. I'm not sure where, but
Representative Conn, we do have to move on.
Okay.
We are way behind schedule. We spent almost 45 minutes on this, and we do have to, to move to...
Those 2 points about schools
Absolutely.
And about getting the language to the children who were the ones that we wanted.
President Conn, I think that's very important, but I do thank you for that, and Director Hill, we're going to appreciate it, and we're going to move to the gambling board, and we're going to have to move right along, and hopefully you can present this in about 20 minutes so we can get so we can stay on schedule.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Director, please state your name and your position and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the Executive Director of the Gambling Control Board. Ahead of the meeting, we did provide a couple of handouts, the blue copies, our annual report, a recent newsletter, which I might refer to when we get into some of the details of relative to our budget, and also a pie chart of where the money goes. Those are kind of the key questions I hear up most often that travel through the offices of legislators. But to be very brief as I can, the Gambling Control Board regulates charitable gaming. We don't have any oversight over the lottery or the racing commission. But with that being said, in Minnesota, it's the activity for charitable gaming is over $1.2 billion in gross receipts, number one in the country. As relates to our regulatory oversight, we've become one of the smallest in comparison to other states and their regulatory oversight. To be as brief as I can, and I think the focus is on the budget, I did have the opportunity to meet with Ms. Roberts, and just by way of background, we had actually proposed 3 change requests relative to our budget. And working with the staff at Minnesota Management and Budget, they pared that down to a one-page or one change item request. But for the purpose of presentation today, I'm going to be referring to our one-page summary of those 3 changes that affect our budget so everybody can hopefully understand a little easier.
Great.
Even I was confused when the numbers came out. But
greatly appreciate.
Thank you. I briefly put part one of the change request simply deals with our being up front. We were appropriated funding based on the anticipation of the electronic gaming. As many know, or what you might have read, that hasn't materialized as we had hoped or we had expected. But at the same time, and now I'm going to refer to our newsletter that's in front of you, Gaming News on pages 4 and 5. Take a look at that section, because we try to highlight those sites, those charities that did elect to get into the electronic format in addition to their paper sale games. But you can see how those sales at those sites started with the solid black paper pull tab gross, and then the impact of the electronic gaming at, like I said, these select sites. My point here is, for those sites that have elected to take on that format, it appears to be working very well. The unfortunate part is it's only in about 7% of the total sites, 2,700 total sites we have. So with that being said, we acknowledge that the activity isn't taking place, and therefore the need for the additional staff and regulatory oversight isn't. So we're actually coming before to say we don't need the $3.9 million. We want to be staffed at where we're currently at, and that's the $3.2 million. So basically it amounts to a proposed reduction of nearly $700,000 for our staffing of the Gambling Control Board. Part two of the change request also is related to the electronic gaming. We work very close with our counterparts, the Department of Public Safety, as it relates to criminal activity. Our authority, the Gambling Control Board, is civil. We find a case or a situation where it could involve criminal, then we do the referral to them. In anticipation of the expectation of the increased activity, they also were provided an increase in appropriation of $250,000 per year. Reality is obviously setting in, and so that reduction to the tune of about $180,000. That doesn't come through this committee. That's actually going through public safety. But the money comes out of our dedicated funds. So that's why we present it here. So reduction in their appropriation as well. The third part, actually, it does involve a fee adjustment. Now, we receive no general fund dollars for our regulatory oversight. All our fees are based on the manufacturers, the distributors, make and deliver the products, the charities that sell the games, and then the actual a percent of the sale of the games goes towards our regulation. The last time we did a fee adjustment goes back to 2004. So based on what we project out in terms of our current budget with the reduction and the anticipation of revenue, the dedicated account would be short. The bank would be short. So we're simply asking for an adjustment of 0.05% in the monthly regulatory fee. Yes, this would be an increased cost that's paid based on sales from the charities, but it's a matter of keeping our level of regulation intact, being the biggest in the country, and hopefully it's with the governor's support that we do this fee adjustment to maintain simply where we're at today. With that, I stand for questions, and hopefully as brief as that was.
We appreciate the concise report. Any questions from members? Representative Kahn?
This might be more for staff, but looking at the first page of the annual report, you give about 10% of your net, of your gross receipts, goes to taxes or charitable expenditures. And how does that compare with the other forms of gambling that we have in the state?
Who wants to...
And I that might not be fair to ask for an immediate response to that, but...
Director Barrett?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we wanted to take a stab. Again, we're not the revenue agency, but certainly mindful of the other counterparts in the gaming side of things. So starting off with tribal, that's really has no jurisdiction other than some oversight of monitoring the slot payouts, and there's a fee that they pay. They don't pay any gambling tax. The Racing Commission, by virtue of where their proceeds go, there's no gambling tax paid back to the state. It's the lottery paying roughly 6.5% in lieu of sales tax that the state collects. And then the charitable gaming, depending upon the point of view, I know we try to keep apples with apples in terms of a tax comparison, but there's also a tax on the charities on net receipts, and so you'll hear charities talk about that tax. But if we try to get apples with apples, it's roughly just under 4% of a tax based on gross receipts, or based on gross receipts from charitable gaming that goes to the state. So 4%, 6.5%, zero racing, zero tribal.
Representative Kahn?
Okay, follow-up. And then someone should put the lottery in there in a... You know,
okay.
As a comparison, that might be more in terms of what people do making daily choices on gambling. That might be something that is more comparable.
All right. Thank you, Representative Albury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in your change request, the first two points, roughly $880,000, but that has no bearing as. I understand from the previous question has no bearing on your third change request. Is that correct?
Director Barrett.
Yep, Mr. Chair and Representative. If we didn't request a reduction, we'd be asking for a lot more fee increase. But the reality is we don't see the activity going where we thought it would in terms of activity at the sites. So if we were not to receive a reduction, then the fee increase presumably would have been a lot more. So that does have an impact in that respect.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, if you can extrapolate for us in the committee, you know, based on either previous 2014 or 2013, based upon the amount of the increase that you're requesting, what amount of revenue would that create?
Director Barrett.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I understand what would it generate as far as if we had that full activity with electronics. Good, very good question. Quite a bit. Again, if you look at the sites, and again, that's just a representative sample, but in many of those cases, the sales at those particular locations that took on the electronic gaming have all doubled their activity. But it's a different, we're a regulatory model. We can't require anybody to do it. The opportunity is there for those folks. They're starting to take note with the information we're providing, but based on what the reality has been, it's been much slower than anticipated.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. you've been asked to increase your budget by 1.8%, and in most cases, the reflection upon by other agencies that have come before this committee has suggested that that's going to go towards, or it's inferred that that is intended towards providing for salary increases, insurance increased costs, that type of thing. And so my question is, as I look at the change requests, doesn't seem like your budget is in need of it based upon the true change request that reduces the overall budget, but yet I'm in a conundrum from your part three in terms of you do need more money. So maybe you can help me understand in terms of the moving pieces here, and if you would, please provide to the committee, as has been stated by the chair, what that 1.8% would be used for in the coming biennium should it be adopted by the legislature.
Director.
Yep, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, with regard to the 1.8, as all agencies for the most part, that was a budget adjustment to reflect towards the salary, and we plan to follow up in writing to Chair Anderson in that respect. In terms of the reduction and how that impacts, again, the what we went forward with is here's where we're currently staffed at. We were anticipating increasing staff and increasing regulatory oversight, but in reality, that activity is not happening as we projected, so we brought it back down to the same level that we've been at for the last 2 years. And it was with that base level, without anticipating the increase, but then with management and budget and the governor's recommendation, knowing that the salary adjustments for the bargaining units, that's where, as everybody, other agencies, it's back up. So we didn't factor in a fluff or extra for the salaries. That was simply based on where we're currently staffed. Now, as relates to the third, the dedicated fee, if we were to look at our operations, receives base level funding the same level we're at. But if we go to the bank to cover our expenses, that's where the fee adjustment, our anticipated revenue based on the number of organizations, the manufacturers, the games, we would not have enough money to cover the base level funding. And so that's why it's a 0.05% adjustment just to get us to cover those base level expenditures. I hope I've explained it.
So Director Barrett, that increase in number three, that part three, how much revenue will that produce in your estimation?
Yes, Mr. Chair, at the very bottom in the bold, the first year it's anticipated $559,000, the second year approximately $610,000.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Errol Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then to follow on, and maybe this is more of an op-ed than a question posed to you, it would appear to me, based on your answer, that you really didn't need nor had you asked for the 1.8% increase. And based upon the efficiency of your budget, you don't need it going forward.
Director Barrett.
Mr. Chair and Representative, again, I don't think the bargaining unit increase has been negotiated. This is what the advice of MMB in terms of expected increase. You know, if they came in at a zero adjustment, but we're certainly following the advice. We simply went forward, what's our base, what's the expectation, and we waited for the direction from MMB as far as 1.8. So we do need it, especially anticipating a bargaining unit adjustment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to follow along on this one sheet, make sure I understand it correctly. So is the change request for number three, does that fill in the proposed cut then and change one? Is that what you said?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative, correct. Yes.
And does that, thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that give you comfort in terms of being the smallest in regulatory funding? Is that a sufficient amount to do the necessary regulation of
Director Barrett.
This area?
Mr. Chair and Representative, fair question. I would love to have our staff doing audits annually for all the organizations. That doesn't happen. But we're simply looking at the level we've been at for the last few years, knowing, working with the industry in terms of maintaining that sense of balance, good regulation, good conduct, the integrity of the games. So we're comfortable in the sense of where we're at. But it is fragile. It's very big. You can see some of the electronic activity and where that might take. But At the same time, we've learned tremendous amount of value, and I don't want to sound like I'm promoting gambling or electronics, but a regulatory oversight in that format has given us a step up that we've never had before. Prior to that time, it was all paper, reporting, monitoring. Now we have some real-time activity where we're watching those sites, working with the charities, and it's really been an improvement in regulatory over in that site. So thank you for that opportunity.
Representative Kahn.
Going back to a previous controversy, which I assume isn't one anymore, going back to your youth activities, how has the support of things like girls' hockey and girls' sports gone? What is the kind of proportional distribution there? And has there been any case, I remember the law we specifically passed said that you couldn't refuse any reasonable request. Has there been any activity on that basis?
Director?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, to the point as it relates to the distribution of proceeds to youth activities, and this goes back years, and I think you were one of the lead authors, to make sure that the ladies received funding when requested. Happy to say that we have not had one complaint or issue filed in that respect. Now, with that said, we do see some disproportionate money paid for the boys' activities, boys' hockey versus the girls', but that's just simply who's requesting the money, but there hasn't been a complaint filed.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, do the people who are running the girls' athletics know that they can make that specific request?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. And that's, I think, as we continue, you know, go through the state and do some education, especially like veterans groups. They're not only just supporting veterans, but they spend a tremendous amount on youth activities, and we include that provision that it's available to all, not just the one.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz. No? Representative Depper.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And regarding, you know, I represent and belong to VFW, American Legion organizations, and one problem they see in the last few years is the amount of taxes that they're paying on their charitable works and also the auditing situation. Has that been addressed with your organization?
Director?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, I want to differentiate between audits because my staff will do what we call compliance reviews. They're similar to audits. We get out roughly once every 2 years. As I said earlier, I'd love to increase that. But I think what you're referring to is certain organizations, by virtue of their revenue, their income, there's a separate law under revenues books that they're required to have an annual audit when it exceeds, I think, $750,000. I might be wrong. Mm-hmm. So that's a separate audit, and it's one that's costly in terms of the charitable organization to meet that requirement. But at the same time, we'd certainly welcome, any organization would welcome an audit for the right reasons and do it. But I think in terms of consideration to raise that threshold similar to other charitable organizations when they hit a limit with the Attorney General's office and they're required to file separate from the gambling portion. So I know there's some discussion with industry reps and maybe a bill up for consideration in that respect. But as regulator, I would say we certainly, any organization should welcome an audit, but at what time and what's the appropriate request for the audit?
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate for the short, concise budget overview, and we appreciate you presenting in front of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
So if we could have the Racing Commission director down. And hopefully, Director, you can be as short and concise as your predecessor here was. I greatly appreciate it. You could state your name and your position for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. As you know, the commission's responsible for licensing all participants in racing and card rooms, protecting the safety and welfare of all the participants, human and equine in racing, protecting the integrity of the games that take place, auditing and tracking the movement of about $100 million that flow through the card rooms and the racetracks, and administering $1 million in Minnesota Breeders' Fund revenues. The commission has 10 full-time employees. Three of them are involved in licensing, and those three people license 5,500 individuals and business entities. We have three investigators that do background checks of those 5,500 licensees. Those three people are also responsible for oversight and surveillance of the card rooms 24/7, monitoring of the backside and all the racing activities during the racing season, and conducting background checks for all applicants. We're also doing parimutuel auditing, and as I said, we administer the Breeders' Fund. We also get outstanding support from the Small Agency Resource Team. They provide finance and HR support for us, and we're appreciative for the work they do. In the last year, I was appointed in December of 2013. I spent 30 years at 3M. So part of what I've been trying to do is to bring the best practices from a company like 3M that operates with tremendous operational discipline to the practices of the Racing Commission. I'm pleased to say that after two relatively unsatisfactory OLA audits in 2005 and 2010, our financial controls and our internal controls in this year's audit were found to be compliant with the state's accounting and financial practices. We got a very good audit report. We also hired a deputy director, a person from Chicago who's been involved in the industry, but also has a financial and accounting background and was the operational head of a $400 million company in the industry. And he, too, has brought tremendous discipline and improvement to our budget and finance operations. Our IT systems continue to be a plague on the organization. This was pointed out in the 05 audit and the 10 audit, and once again in the 15 audit. Our IT systems have been underinvested over the years. They continue to fail and impose impediments to our day-to-day business operations. Just by way of example, in November and December this year, during the peak of our licensing season, we were down for 9 days because of a server failure. So imagine that the Department of Motor Vehicles could not license Minnesota drivers for 9 days. It would have been quite a flap, and that is unacceptable to me as the head of the organization. And so we are working with a private entity, a state-authorized private entity, to refashion our licensing system and to do it ourselves. And we hope to have that up and running by the racing season. We have significant structural budget issues. I've spoken about these issues at other House and Senate committee hearings. Our financing basically comes from those licensees each year. We get about $600,000 in license fees from the racetracks themselves, from the two racetracks, Running Aces and Canterbury, and we get about $200,000 a year in license fees of individuals. That amounts to roughly $800,000, and I'm speaking in gross numbers here. That revenue stream has been flat for as far back as the eye can see. I was looking at our annual report from last year, and 6 or 7 years ago, we were still getting only about $800,000 in licensing revenue. In fact, many years below that. Our operating expenditures have gone up, like any organization, for salary and other reasons, and those now are running at about a $1.1 million running rate. Last year, we came to the legislature and asked for a special funding, access to our special revenue fund that had been underspent for many years, and the legislature gave us $185,000 to get through the remainder of this biennium. Much of that went for legal expenses. When I arrived, the commission was being sued by the former deputy director. We settled that lawsuit. We also had other extraordinary expenses due to a number of investigations that took place prior to my coming to the commission. So we've gotten through the storm, so to speak. We also get funding from a reimbursement account. So the cost of overseeing the card rooms, the cost of veterinarian services and drug testing during the racing seasons, all of which amounts to about $2 million, is reimbursed from the two racetracks to the commission, and that forms the remainder of our budget. We've improved the discipline by which we monitor those oversight costs, and so the cost of the tracks have gone up considerably by about 20% in the last couple years because we're doing a better job of allocating what we spend on card room oversight and other reimbursable expenses and imposing those costs on the tracks themselves. So again, the image here is of a closed-loop system, completely self-financed with very little or no state funding. It's self-funded by the industry participants. That's a system that is going to have to be closely examined because it doesn't work, at least going into the next biennium. But what we've proposed in our change request are three things. Two of them require statutory reform. Our license fees on individual licensees have been capped at $100 since, I believe, the statute was first passed in 1983. That's against an inflation rate of 138% since that time. So we have vendors who come into the state, large vendors who provide gaming equipment, names like Bally's that you'll recognize, that pay $100 to do business in the state of Minnesota. We've looked at comparable jurisdictions, $1,500, $5,000, $15,000 for gaming vendors to go in the states to do business. So we think it's anachronistic to have a $100 vendor fee for large companies that are providing gaming equipment who require more intensive background checks. If their systems fail, it undermines the integrity of the operations of wagering and gaming in Minnesota. So our proposal is to lift the $100 cap, to propose a fee increase for individual licensees, which would be everybody from the grooms on the backside to the 2,000 or so employees at the track, still keeping them well below the $100 ceiling, but creating a new class of vendors for gaming vendors that would be $1,500 per year and more accurately reflect the costs that we incur in regulating them. The second change request deals with multi-year licensing. In Minnesota, really from the beginning, licensees have to be relicensed every year. This imposes a lot of administrative costs on our licensed people. We get a rush prior to the racing season and a rush at the end of the year where thousands of people descend on us for licenses. Most racing jurisdictions have three-year licenses for certain categories of licensees, and primarily this would be owners. People that we know, they return to the track every year. Most of them are Minnesota residents, and they would be able to get a three-year license and return every 3 years for further background checks. This will give us a cash infusion. It's really a cash flow issue because once we go through the notice and comment rulemaking process, which will take a year, we can then impose these license fee increases, and that will net us, I believe, about $109,000 in increased revenue. The third change request is an appropriation from the general fund of $341,000. The governor has proposed it as a one-time appropriation. And in the meantime, what he has asked us to do and what has been on my agenda since I started with the commission is to explore other opportunities for industry growth that will result in a greater revenue stream both for the state and the regulatory authority as well as Minnesota breeders, owners, by money, additional money in purses and additional revenue to the tracks. And we will have a proposal in 2016, we're working on it now, for licensing of a new growth opportunity in Minnesota and pari-mutuel wagering. I want to say just a few words about the letter I got from Representative Anderson yesterday with respect to salary increases. Let me talk first about changes that we've made in order to save money. When I came to the commission, we were running at about $60,000 a year in overtime pay. The people at the small agency resource team told me that was extraordinary by state agency standards. I was not experienced enough to know that. But in any event, through scheduling efficiencies and increased operating efficiencies, we have reduced overtime pay from $60,000 in fiscal year 12 to $6,700 year-to-date today. We're scheduling more efficiently. We've increased the efficiency of our operations, and we're finding less of a need to pay people one and a half times pay for overtime. I also found that we had investigators that were on call, meaning they were available for 16 hours a day, even though they were working 8 hours a day. They were on call to the card room so that if anything happened, they could be called and they could help the card rooms and the tracks troubleshoot. On-call pay amounted to $86,540 in fiscal year 14. I reviewed whether that was necessary, benchmarked with other regulatory agency, talked to the investigators, talked to the card room surveillance people, the track management, and we decided that the executive director and the deputy director would be on call 24/7, and the investigators need not be. So we have achieved a 65% reduction in on-call pay, or a net savings of $56,500 in year-to-date. We have also invested in our people. One person was in need of a promotion. She had not been promoted and was well deserving of one, and we promoted her. And I also worked with management and budget to reclassify two of our investigators who were terribly underclassified in terms of their pay grade, and they are now being more equitably paid for what they contribute and what their background and experience brings to the commission. With respect to salary for myself, I think I got a 2% pay increase this year. I should tell you that the state searched for an executive director for over a year. We had two national searches for an executive director before I was offered the position. People told us across the country they would not come to Minnesota because the salary for executive director was not on a par with other racing commissions across the country. So I will leave you with that and be happy to answer any questions, and I hope you'll endorse the change request that we've requested.
Thank you, Director. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I know there's Canterbury's in my district, and there's some issues with testing of the horses, that there's new technology or upgraded technology. Some of the typical protocol that some of the breeders are using were based on the former capabilities of the testing, and so it certainly has been brought to my attention more than several times that there's some good people getting bad labels simply because what medical people had told them, this is what protocol must do for when you medicate a horse, when you have to stop medicating a horse, how many days before a race, and the new testing actually has a much finer filter. Could you talk about that a little bit, or if anything's being looked at regarding that?
Yes, Director. I'm happy to. Mr. Chair, Representative Lunan. There was a kerfuffle in 2011 that had to do with a changeover in technology. That is long past. Minnesota has the same rate of positives as other jurisdictions. About 99.67 is our rate of tests that pass. We test roughly the same number of participants as other jurisdictions, so we're right at the midpoint. I was involved in analytical chemistry at 3M before I came here. Yes, we can detect at part per quadrillion levels any analyte that we're looking for. There are 26 approved therapeutic medications. Everything else is prohibited. So any finding of a prohibited medication is an attempt to cheat and will have a penalty. Overages on therapeutic medications can be innocent. They could be administered inside the time in which you're supposed to administer them. But the trainers have absolute responsibility under the law, and if they have an overage, it's still a performance-enhancing effect. Mm-hmm. It still cheats other people out of the purse, and we will take enforcement action. I believe that we're acting basically in line with what other jurisdictions are doing.
Representative Lewis,
thank you, Mr. Commissioner. And you bring up purses. There's, I believe, an account or a fund for Minnesota-bred horses. How is that allocated, or how is that dispersed, or who benefits from that?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lunan, the purse distributions are generally agreed upon between the horse people's organizations and the tracks prior to the season. So for every class of race, whether it's a maiden or a one-time winner or a stakes race, there's a designated purse amount that's written into the schedule. And that's typically agreed to. And it is a point of negotiation between the horse people and the tracks. How much of an extra first benefit is going to be given to state-bred races. And state-bred races, as you know, have been juiced quite a bit in the last few years from the agreement with the tribe.
One last one. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The when you, and again, Canterbury is in my district, and we have he had mentioned a collaboration between Mystic Lake and Canterbury, that has been very, very positive for our area. Working together, in fact, we've got other entities getting involved in what we call the River South, which is basically Minnesota's version of the Wisconsin Dells, if you will. And I just want to make a comment, invite any legislators to come down to the Land of Fun and to see all the things that we've got going on down there.
Thank you.
If I might, Mr. Chair, I'll also mention that Canterbury is investing in its facility with $1 million reconstruction project of its clubhouse and added the activity center last year, so it's developing really well.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Director DePasquale, you got my attention almost immediately when you, I believe, called your IT systems a plague on the system. A couple of questions for you. One, who's providing your IT services for you? If you could detail for me again how many days you were down, the financial impact for that, and the potential or planned remedy to get that addressed. If you could give me some greater detail on
certainly,
that.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative. The IT system was down in November and December for licensing only for a period of 9 days. It was a server crash. It was also down rather unhappily on Kentucky Derby Day when a lot of employees are coming back for the first day and getting their licenses. Or horse people are coming back. I can't remember the exact count of days, but it's roughly 10 to 12 days this year where our licensing function was down. We've had other glitches along the way, but you know the IT system, Minute provides our IT services. I don't think I mentioned that. But we are going to GL Solutions, which used to be called Government Licensing Solutions, and they are an approved contractor of the state. They license the Cosmetology Board, which licenses over 50,000 people a year, and they do it very efficiently. And our staff has been working with them for the last 3 or 4 months. It'll be relatively inexpensive. $2,000 a month will be the running rate for their licensing services. And as soon as it's up and running and we know we don't have any infant mortality or any problems, we'll drop the Minute system for licensing. But we'll keep it for this year just to make sure that everything runs smoothly. Our costs for Minute approach $200,000 a year on a budget of $800,000. And we have talked with them about trying to negotiate downward, but there's not a lot of flexibility there.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, $200,000 a year you're spending with Minute now, for what is it you're going to be replacing? With the GL Solutions, are you going to be replacing all of that, part of that, portions of that?
We're replacing, Mr. Chair, Representative, we're replacing part of that, the licensing mechanism.
Okay.
But Minute still provides all the services that it provides to other agencies, including, you know, your emails and
sure.
things of that sort, which, by the way, I should note, we've got desktops from the 20th century. We do not have voicemail at the commission. Coming from 3M, I was a little surprised at the IT systems that we have, but it's been cobbled together over time, and we also need to enhance our parimutuel auditing ability. Some jurisdictions have gone to private entities that charge about $60,000 a year to do parimutuel auditing. We're trying to do that ourselves, but we're going to need to improve our IT systems to do that.
Mr. Chair, if you could provide for the committee at a hopefully very soon date, help us understand the cost that you're going to be replacing backed out of Minute, what you're currently being charged for. Obviously, you're being charged for other things, but the piece that you're going to be replacing with GL Solutions, could you provide a financial analysis of that for us, please?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Carls.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, my question also dealt with testing, but in a little different direction. If I recall correctly, years ago it was the University of Minnesota Department of Veterinary Medicine that did the testing. And my first question, are they still the ones that do the testing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. We've contracted with Industrial Laboratories in Colorado for the last several years. There are only five nationally approved labs. I believe there's about five that have been certified by the Racing Medication and Testing Consortium as having meeting both ISO standards for analytical chemistry as well as their equipment, and Industrial Labs is one of them.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, my follow-up question, regardless of who did the testing, was how is that paid for? Do the does the track pay for it? Do the horse owners pay for it? Being that we're talking about budget, how is that handled?
Yeah, Mr. Correct. Chair, Representative, it's reimbursed by the tracks. It is about $200,000 a year in testing. We test the first two finishers of each race, and we do random testing occasionally. I can't tell you the exact number of tests, but if you multiply the number of races, it's times two, generally, is the number of tests. And then we have other certified labs that test split samples. If we get a positive, a trainer and owner has a right to a split sample, because we keep splits when we take them, and we send them to another lab that is of their choice, but on our list of certified labs, to confirm the original finding.
And Mr. Chairman, just one final question, and in terms of the payment there, is our process there then where you reimburse typical of most tracks across the country, or do they have other payment mechanisms for the testing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think in most cases it's reimbursed by the racetracks, but there are states that pay for it out of general funds.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to be running short of time here, but we got one last. Representative Carlson Johnson, you're done. We got to move on, so I really appreciate, Director, I greatly appreciate your presentation here, and I'll follow up and leave you with one last request there that the Chair Anderson always asks, is to kind of give us, provide us with a later time here where that 1.8% increase is going to go and how you plan to distribute that in your organization. So
thank you for your time.
So then we'll have the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. As you, and if you could please state your name and your title and who you represent for the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mike McKellen. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and I believe you all have packets. So to prevent any further delay, we'll just proceed through the presentation unless you'd like to see it above. I know in the past we've had problems with the PowerPoint size and people couldn't see the information on there.
We've got it, so okay. Please proceed.
So, Mr. Chair, today we're just going to give you a quick overview of the agency, run through our financial information, and then submit to you the governor's budget change item proposals. So as a reminder to the committee members, our mission is dedicated to serving the Minnesota veterans and their families around the state, and we do this through providing proven and innovative programs and services so that we can maximize their quality of life. And we're able to do this. We own and operate five veterans homes across the state that provides 24 hours a day, 7 days a week skilled nursing care. We operate two domiciliaries, and we have the second in the nation adult daycare service, which provides respite for veterans and their family members, or correction, their family members. We operate four major program areas with a variety of services within each of those programs. And we're able to do all this not just as an agency, but we partner quite a bit with the U.S. Veterans Affairs as well as veteran service organizations throughout the state, the county veteran service officers in all 87 counties, and also partners in nonprofits and for-profit organizations. As just a little bit more context, there's approximately 369,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota. Again, they range throughout all 87 counties. That's about 7% of the overall state population, which is veterans. Approximately 66,000 of those veterans have served since 9/11, and 43,000 of those have been in combat zones globally. The average age of the 9/11 veterans is approximately 35. Our largest population of veterans currently are the Vietnam era veterans. There's approximately 126,000 of those within the state. And when you look at the differences in male and female, about 8% of the veterans are female and 92% are male. One of the things we want to note with this population of veterans is we have a significant aging population. Approximately 21% of our veterans out of that 369,000 are age 65 to 74, and then about 24% are age 75 and older. So we've got a significant aging population of veterans. That is a very, very, very quick run-through of programs and services. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to our finance director, John Powers, who's going to give you an update on our finances.
Mr. Chair, representatives, John Powers, finance director for MDVA. I believe it's slide 7 shows what our 2016-17 base budget is. It's a $270 million biennial budget. $125.5 million of it comes from the general fund, of which $93 million is transferred into the veterans' homes and $32.5 million for the programs and services. On the home side, $94.8 million is received from VA per diem and resident maintenance charges. During this next biennium, we expect to have about $42.5 million in federal construction, which is primarily for the Minneapolis campus, and then we also are building a new cemetery down in the Preston area. $2.4 million of it is in special revenue funds, which consist of the support our troops license plates, fees that we collect from the cemetery, and the canteens within the homes. We have $4.3 million in resident trust and gift accounts, and we expect to spend $500,000 out of the open appropriation account for the Minnesota GI Bill, of which we transfer $3.5 million of that over to the Office of Higher Ed. In FY15, we expect to have the same amount of FTEs, which is 1,182. With this current base budget, we will have to reduce our FTEs in FY16 by 74 positions, and in FY17, we'll have to decrease another 11 positions in addition to the 74. The next slide on slide 8, I believe it is, the expenditures by fund. We spend 46.6% of the general fund monies, 35.1% from the resident maintenance fees and the VA per diem, and then we have federal construction grants of 15.8%. We're broken down again into two different programs. We have the programs and services and the healthcare side, which is the homes. And the programs and services makes up about 13.3% of our budget, and the homes 86.7%. The graph on the right shows the breakdown, the different categories: payroll 58.4%, operating expenses at 18.6%, and the capital outlay again for the construction is 15.6%. Currently, we spend about 75% of our budget on, if you take out the capital outlay for the construction project, we spend about 75% on our payroll of our staff. The next slide shows sort of a breakdown of where the money goes within the different programs. Column A and B represent the department as a total. As you can see, it replicates basically the graph that was in the prior slide. $270 million budget for the department, 46.6% for the general fund, 35.1% of the miscellaneous special revenue fund. Column C, D, and E represent our programs and services program, and again, majority of the funding there comes from the general fund. Columns F, G, and H represent the veterans' health care. A note on the general fund of $93 million is transferred into the miscellaneous special fund, but it for our purposes, I've showed it here as the general fund appropriation, which is what it is. And then the miscellaneous special revenue fund, about $95 million, which is about 40% of that budget, comes from the resident maintenance fees and the VA per diem. The next slide shows the breakdown of the programs and services. The Minnesota GI Bill, again, we're going to spend about $500,000. The department will transfer $3.5 million of that over to the higher education. That's a $6 million annual open appropriation. The Veterans Services budget activity, if you will, is made up of the administration, leadership, strategic planning, human resources, communications, finance, legislative affairs, affirmative action, and IT initiatives. And that is $5.9 million, which represent about 16.5% of the program budget and 2.2% of the department budget. We have another budget activity that the core of it, which is the programs and services, which is the state's Soldiers Assistance Program, the Minnesota Service Corps, Link Vet Call Center, state cemeteries, state approving agencies, the Minnesota GI Bill, and the Minnesota Assistant Council for Veterans and the Gold Star Program, which represents about 46.8% of the program budget and 6.2% of the department budget. Our other budget activity is the claims and outreach. We have the claims offices, the veterans outreach, tribal veterans service offices, higher education assistance office, county veterans services grants, and the veterans services organization grants, along with the support our troops funds. The next slide is a breakdown of the health care budget. For the administration side, the veterans health care, we have about 5.4% of the program budget is used for that. Minneapolis Veterans Home is obviously our biggest one, and that 40.7% of the whole program, or 35% of the agency's budget. I've also noted the Minnesota building expansions of $41 million, which represents about 15.4% of the budget. And then the smaller homes that we have in Hastings, Silver Bay, Laverne, and Fergus. And for FY17, we're expecting 1,024.5 positions with this current base budget. For the governor's recommended change items, I believe it's slide 13. The governor is recommending $2.11 million in FY16, which represents a 1.8% increase for the programs and services budget and a 5% increase on the health care side. An additional $4.3 million in FY17 and ongoing is, again, the 1.8% and the 5% in fiscal year 17. What this will do for us is it'll allow us to, rather than short us the 74 positions with our base budget, we'll be able to keep an additional 30.8 FTEs on in FY16, and in 17, 60.6. I also want to note in the biannual budget document that's produced, there's a typo in there on the number of FTEs. So if you are looking at that, I believe it says in FY17 that there'll be 59.1 when it's actually 60.6 FTEs.
And again, as John has talked about, the governor's recommended change item to the base budget. What that's going to do, again, to reiterate, we run 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week operations at our skilled nursing care facilities. Those employees are highly skilled. And as we look at these costs, one thing to note, we are receiving a 5% increase over the biennium. We're well aware that both in the state of Minnesota and nationally, the healthcare costs are increasing at about 4.5% annually. So this is going to be, as mentioned, a decrease to our to our staff and to our operations. We don't see that it's going to cause anything to shut down. It's certainly going to hinder operations, and so we're very aware of that. The next change item, I'm going to skip slide 14 unless there's specific questions, and we'll move to governor's recommended $1 million for repair and betterment of our 50 buildings that comprise over 1 million square feet on 290 acres, and we're currently developing 106 acres in Fillmore County with our new Preston Cemetery in the southeast, so that will add acreage and repair and betterment needs in the future. The buildings range from age of being built in the late 1800s to currently under construction there. If you've been out to the Minneapolis campus, phase two is being built as we speak. The third and final change item recommended by the governor is a change to the Support Our Troops Fund. This doesn't add any additional funding to the agency or any additional FTEs, but what this will do is it will allow us grant-making authority so that we can... We received this money from the SOT funds from the sale of Support Our Troops license plates. They're $35 to purchase, and then we split that money with the Department of Military Affairs. And so those funds are general donations from the community, and we're hearing... the feedback we're getting is there's not the public trust is diminishing in what those funds are being used for. So what this change item will do is it will allow us to have grant making authority so that we can distribute those funds to innovative veteran programs out in throughout the state. So that's the third and final change item from the governor. Second to the last slide 17, I'm going to turn it back over to John so he can kind of roll this up. We went through a lot of information. I saw a lot of confused looks. I apologize for that, but this hopefully will clear it all up.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, again, columns A and B show what our actual FY14-15 numbers look like when it comes to the general fund. $126.2 million, and again, we have 1182 FTEs. Columns C, D, and E represents the base, which I went over briefly at the beginning of. And again, if you look at programs and services, we have a base FTE of 74.5 positions. Without a salary supplement, we'll have to reduce 8.9 positions and an additional 10 positions in FY17. On the healthcare side, and again, this is column D and E, on the healthcare side, without a salary supplement, we'll have to reduce 65.6 positions in FY16 and an additional 10 in FY17. The totals down at the bottom there represent D and E again. Total 73.6 reduction, 85.3 reduction in FY17. If we look at the governor's recommendations for F, G, and E columns, the governor is recommending $330,000 for the biennium, which will allow us to keep on an additional 1.5 FTEs in both FY16 and 17. On the healthcare side, it would allow us to keep an additional 29.3 and 59.1 in FY17. Columns G and H on the bottom there shows you the difference between what the governor is recommending and what we actually would need to keep on the additional 43.6 FTEs and 24 or roughly 25 positions in FY17.
Well, thank you, and I will take some. We got some questions here, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your testimony is, from my perspective, very compelling. Given you know what we are charged or what we charge these individuals with, in terms of defending our country, but in your comments, you mentioned skilled care, skilled services. My suspicion is that's only going to intensify in the years to come based upon the veterans that are returning with the types of issues that they have to face and deal with, and the dark demons, if you will. So in your comments about funding for these programs, not having to ask you to choose, but is it better to emphasize the level of care that they are being provided or the bricks and mortar that it is housed in? If you had to choose, which one is going to be the emphasis going forward, or which one is more appreciable by the people that come to you for assistance?
Direct.
Mr. Chair and Representative, they complement one another. I don't think that we could really separate the two, and we don't do that now. We have to have the facilities to perform the service required, and so it's really one and the same. We're currently undergoing CMS certification at some of our homes. We've accomplished that at Minneapolis, and there are higher standards of care. There's new needs, if you will, to provide that type of care. So as we look at the incoming veterans with TBI and amputations and PTSD, and we realize that there's a lot of research out there now that will that leads one to believe that TBI is a precursor, not necessarily the cause of Alzheimer's and dementias, but certainly related to that issue. We look at that, and we have to be able to treat it, as you said. And so I don't know that we can separate the skill and the need and the facilities necessary from the actual treatment provided to the veterans.
One more. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to follow up to your point about PTSD and with the issue that's been relevant, and we've seen it in the news with regard to the suicide prevention of our returning veterans. And I'm just wondering, in terms of, if you could expand in terms of what this budget emphasize, how does it emphasize, how does it is it positioned to take better care of those that are on the verge of doing something as catastrophic as that? How do we address meeting their needs at the point of the crucible, if you will, where we can affect, you know, saving their life?
Director.
And Mr. Chair and Representative, so again, it's a collective process with our agency, the Veterans Affairs, the county veteran service officers, and nonprofits. First, you have to identify the veterans. Oftentimes, we realize that there's second, third, fourth stage effects to issues associated with time spent in a combat zone. We realize that there are effects with non-employment or unemployment or underemployment in some cases. So what we do collectively with all these programs and services that we provide, and then our domiciliaries, if someone is elevated to that position, or long-term care in our skilled nursing facilities, is we collectively work with individual veterans to determine what their needs are. The veterans earn a lot of benefits from their service. And so one thing we do with the grants to the county veteran service officers is they bring them into the system. We often talk about our agency as a bridge to the federal benefits that they've earned. And oftentimes those benefits can offset issues that veterans may be suffering from. Perhaps unemployment is an issue. If they've earned the GI Bill or some kind of higher education benefit, or they can apply for those benefits through us and take advantage of that and improve their life. Again, our mission and our vision and the initial opening slides was to provide a better quality of life. So that's one way to do it. If it gets to a point where a veteran is homeless, for example, or in an area where, or a point in their life where they're experiencing potential homeless, that can cause great strife upon them. So we turn to our partners like MACV, LSS. We have counseling out there. We get them connected to the VA to see if we can work through some of those issues. So there's not a silver bullet for every person's particular issues. It's a collective mass of all these benefits and services out there that we are able to maneuver a veteran through and hopefully help them to prevent getting to the point of suicide. If there's a veteran that is suffering a severe psychological situation, we would hope that they would be admitted to the VA or perhaps receiving help in any of the continuums of care. But it's our position, it's our It's our priority to get them there and to provide services along the way that will help mitigate that ultimate.
I'm just going to ask folks to be. We're going to go over a little bit here to keep on this, but I'll ask folks to keep your questions concise, and hopefully the director can keep his responses concise so we can continue to move. So, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll be very quick. I want to go back to slide 7 on page 3 at the top. And when you went over that slide, you referenced cemeteries and fees. And I'm interested in what fees, and I've got a number of relatives, my father, grandfather, and several other close relatives buried at Fort Snelling. And at least in two of the cases, I was the executor, and I don't recall any fees at Fort Snelling. And so, for example, Preston, and I think there's another one up northern Minnesota that are state-operated, what are those fees and how do they compare then with the federal cemetery at Fort Snelling?
Director.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. The fees are, I believe, are actually for the spouses and the kids of the veteran. So if they choose to be buried within that cemetery, that those are the fees that they would have to pay in order to get buried there.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, how does that part of it then, my main question was the veteran, but now that you mentioned the spouse, how does that compare then with Fort Snelling relative to spouses or children?
I see we're phoning for help. please state your name for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Brad Lindsay. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Programs and Services for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Chair, a representative, every veteran that is buried in our state cemeteries, we get a reimbursement from the federal government of $750. So any spouses or eligible family members, we charge a fee for their burial as well of $750, a matching amount. Fort Snelling, I'm not 100% sure. I do not believe they collect any fees on spouses or eligible family members, though.
Yeah. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop there in the interest of time, but I didn't recall writing any checks relative to Fort Snelling. That's why I was asking the question, but it's been a long time since my father passed away, so it was early 90s, so maybe things had changed. Thank you.
And Representative Carlson, I don't believe, I think that as long as they're underage children or still a married spouse, I believe out in Snelling they do get buried for free, so or at the cost of the government. So I think that might just be a difference in operations of our state facility.
And Mr. Chairman, that's why I was asking the question, what was the difference? Thank you.
Great. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question just regards to the overall budget. In regards to what I looked at as I did the number crunching to make sure that I understood what you said, it looks like the current biennium was almost a 20% increase in previous biennium, and the forecast currently is a 5% increase for this next biennium, with the governor's proposal of about an 8% growth in that time. And it sounded to me like what you were saying is that we still are having an issue with trying to balance the budget, and in order to do that, we're only looking at FTE reductions. All the budgets that I've been involved with, we always look at personnel as one of those options of balancing the budget. Is there not a way for us to maintain some of those FTEs and look at other expense areas? Or are we just looking at FTE changes in order to balance that equation?
Director.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we definitely look at other areas that we can look to reduce. However, I believe that we sort of glanced over the slide. If you we did not receive any salary supplement during this current biennium. MMB had recommended that we take a look at our increases from FY13 to 14, and overall both programs almost increased by 6% the increase in salary dollars. As you know, the state employees received an increase on January 1st of 2013, which was followed up again at the beginning of July of FY14, an additional increase was given then also. And at the beginning of this fiscal year, an additional 3% increase was given, and as a whole, it was about 5% for our agency, given the fact that we have to give performance-based raises also, which amounts to about 1.8%. So this is just to cover those costs. It's not to say that we wouldn't look for other areas to improve, but that's not accounting for the other increase in health care non-salary costs that are also increasing that we're not seeking money for at this time.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. It seems like I did understand it correctly then, so thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. The questions I have has to do, you talked about cutting 74 and then possibly adding back, and I guess the question I have is, where are these cuts coming from? Are they coming from nursing staff? Are they coming from support staff in your office? If we can get, we don't have to answer that right now, but if you can get us that information, that would be nice, so that we know, you know, we're not going to end up with the 74 cuts being top heavy in one area and where we need services cutting people out of there. So that's just kind of get an idea where those cuts are coming from.
Commissioner, if you're going to provide that at a later time.
Yeah, we certainly can.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Representative Lunan.
I'll pass. That was my question, Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Representative Salt.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What's the shortage of the number of beds in veterans' homes? Compared, what's the demand and what's the shortage, and how are you going to, if there is a shortage, how do you deal with that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, we're going to have Robin Gostad, the Deputy Commissioner for Healthcare side, answer that.
My name is Robin Gostad. I'm serving as the Acting Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare for Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. The way the beds are licensed, in order to collect a VA per diem and to be able to bill the federal VA for a veteran's care, the VA does an assessment of each state, and that needs assessment produces the number of beds that they feel that state requires for the care of their veterans. And Minnesota is currently licensed by the VA for 1,058 beds. We are currently, our bed capacity for the number of beds that we have in our current facilities, our five veterans homes, we have 814 beds in operation. So after the Minneapolis veterans home campus development is complete, we will be at 300 beds on that campus, an increase from our current 291 beds. And in Building 6, which is also on the Minneapolis campus, we'll have a vacancy of 91 beds. So the current potential bed capacity for new beds after the completion of the Veterans Home in Minneapolis Phase 3 expansion would be 144 beds.
Representative Sullivan.
So, you don't have a waiting list for beds? You have an excess supply of beds, is that right?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misread your question.
Can you just provide that information to us, the number of beds that you've expanded to when that's completed, and what our shortage of beds and what the waiting list is for that? And you could provide that to the committee in essence of time.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And so we're bumping up against the next committee, and we need to vacate, so I appreciate your time and your presentation, and we look forward to that information coming.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
The meeting is adjourned.